So hello, it's Bill Nelson, director of the Sidney Kimmel Comprehensive Cancer Center at Johns Hopkins. And we're here today with Victor Valculescu, who is one of the researchers that we have, who is applying these extraordinary tools that we're using to examine the human genome, not just the one you're born with, but the ones that the cancer cells have. They're, of course, different with these acquired gene defects. And Victor's putting the latest technologies to play in analyzing to figure out what the very nature of cancer is, but also with an eye to figure out how can we better detect it and diagnose it. And I would start with Victor, as I think almost all of our listeners are very aware of the CSI franchises that are on TV, and this notion that, you know, almost always seemingly at the crime scene, somebody finds a single hair or something like that, they can do a DNA test, and they can figure out who the murderer was. Are we to the point yet where we can find a single cancer cell at the crime scene, circulating in the blood or in the urine or coughed up with the sputum or in the stool or something, to indict that cell as threatening someone's life?
Well, Bill, that's a great question. And, you know, you are right in that analogy, in that cancer very much is like, you know, the bad guy at the crime scene. And what technologies have allowed us to do over the last decade or so is move from essentially using genome sequencing to understand the genetic blueprint of cancer in a very basic sense, which is what we were doing about a decade or more ago, to now, in a much more refined way and much more sensitive way, understand what are the differences in the blueprint of a cancer cell compared to our normal tissues, and how do we use that information not only to identify what therapy a patient should go on, that's precision medicine or personalized medicine, not only to understand how the tumors are changing over time, but also to identify, perhaps in non-invasive ways, by looking in the blood or in very minute cell population, how one can see tumors changing during the course of therapy, how one could potentially even detect cancer without having a cancer specimen at all. The technologies now are have truly advanced at an astonishing pace. I'm not sure that even I, who've been in this field for a long time, and you have too, could have imagined today what it is that we can do that that was not at all even close to possible 2 decades ago. We're not quite at the point of having a Star Trek scanner where you can figure out, you know, what's wrong with somebody by just scanning
the tricorder.
We don't have a tricorder yet, but by a simple blood test in patients where you can't get a biopsy, for example, you can never really analyze the tumor tissue directly, we can figure out what are the key changes that are different in that cancer cell versus the normal tissue in that patient, and how we can use that information to help the patient either select therapy or potentially understand what therapies they should not be getting or how their tumor genomes have changed over time.
Well, it's hard not to think, as you mentioned, being in this field for some period of time and helping build it, which you were able to do, is to think about the extraordinary amount of work that went into discovering a few genes that were corrupted or defective in cancers, to now being able to inventory all the genes at once by sequencing the whole genome. So in that sense, for a garden variety colon cancer or breast cancer or lung cancer or what have you, how many gene defects are there in a typical cancer, would you say?
Yeah, and it is a good point. I mean, folks, and I remember this, used to literally spend their entire research careers, clinical careers, perhaps studying a single gene or a single portion of the genome for, you know, a decade of their time. I spent a long time looking at what was likely the gene on chromosome 8P. Anyway, we were still searching for it. The technology, as you said, has moved to the point where we can now look at all the genes at the same time. It's like looking at all the players on the field, trying to understand who's doing what, you know, where the defects are in this particular blueprint in a particular cancer. So the genome is big, but we focus on the portion that encodes genes, as those are the key portions of the genome. And among the 40 million or so bases in the blueprint of an individual's genes, typically there's only about 100 or so mutations in a typical colon cancer. And of those 100, most of them are not really useful. It's only actually a small number that are potentially useful therapeutically to a patient or prognostically, telling you how, you know, you will end up doing based on those mutations. The problem is that it's not the same 100 in every patient. It's different. You know, so there might be some similarities, but there are many things that are different between individuals. And that's what makes this so complicated. Just as you and I have different genetic blueprints, we're different individuals, and essentially everybody's different, even twins, genetically identical individuals can have minor differences. Probably no tumor since the beginning of human time has had the same genetic blueprint as any other tumor. So analyzing these, finding where these 100 mutations are out of the millions of positions in the genome is crucial in order to figure out what the best type of therapy should be for that patient.
So having 100 different, you know, plus or minus how many different types of changes in a cancer, as you mentioned, seems to be daunting to build a treatment that's selective for any individual change. And which cases would it be useful in, which is it not? And that's the precision medicine angle. But one of the advantages that you've been attempting to mine out is that having 100, even if you didn't know a priori which ones there were, is giving you 100 chances to perhaps detect a cancer or the DNA from a cancer in a biospecimen like urine or blood or whatnot. So by using a sequence-based approach and not just a, I know this mutation, I'm looking for it, you can be a little bit indifferent and maybe have 100 chances to find a cancer cell in any individual. Is that panning out in that way, sort of 100 shots on goal, if you will, to finally score for early detection and diagnosis?
You're absolutely right. Having all the different mutations that one can identify in a tumor gives you multiple opportunities. Of course, it gives you multiple opportunities to intervene therapeutically. As we discussed, most of them probably not useful therapeutically, but a few of them are. One key aspect is that when we think of precision medicine, it's really the precision part of it is getting to be the part where we understand the cancer. It's really precision diagnostics. The precision medicine part, where we think of the therapy, is not quite there yet. Like you said, we don't have 100 different ways of treating the cancer. We don't have a different type of therapy for every patient that's out there. There are really only limited number of therapies, and we're trying to match those right therapies to the patient. So that's a very important part when we think about precision medicine. We're getting really good at understanding the cancer. We're still getting better at how we're treating the patient, and we need to do better and better and better at coming up with more precision therapies. However, if you think about then using these mutations for early detection, you're absolutely right. All of these alterations give you an opportunity to identify something that's unique about an individual with cancer versus those that are healthy. And in this case, it's really simple. You have a genetic code. The genetic code's the same in every cell in your body. But now you have some cells in a patient with cancer that have a new mutation, a new alteration in their genetic code, and it's in every one of those cancer cells, and now it's leaching out into the bloodstream or into the urine or other bodily fluids such as the stool in case of colon cancer patients. And you have an opportunity using new methods that are very sensitive, can identify the needle in the haystack to pick out those mutations that are in the blood or in these bodily fluids. And because there are many mutations, you can identify, you have multiple shots on goal, as you said. We recently published a study where we were able to look at 80,000 bases out of the 40 million of our coding genes, looking at 58 of the most commonly mutated genes in cancer, and use that to see, could we identify, without knowing ahead of time what mutations they had, patients with early stage cancers, stage 1, stage 2, colon, breast, lung and ovarian cancers, four of the most common and deadliest types of cancers. And to our, you know, great surprise, it was really a very high fraction of these patients that we could detect with early stage disease. We're able to use this liquid biopsy, as it's called, to detect over half, in some cases two-thirds, maybe even 70%, of early stage patients with these cancers by scanning in the blood for any mutation that shouldn't be there, and then going back and showing that mutation did indeed arise from their tumor. So there's great promise with that kind of technology, as we go forward to think about early detection and early intervention.
Well, here's a question to sort of get you to forecast a little bit. In one way to look at it is some of our best early detection strategies historically for cervical cancer, for colorectal cancer, in fact, actually don't detect cancers early per se. They detect the pre-malignant condition, which we can treat to prevent cancer altogether. And we know that these pre-malignant conditions have acquired gene defects as well. Our typical guess is not as many, and obviously they're not as belligerent in some way. They don't create these cancers that invade into tissues. But has there been enough information on how much pre-malignant conditions contribute to pre-malignant cell DNA in the blood, or pre-malignant cell DNA coughed up from the lungs, or pre-malignant cell DNA shed through the uterine cervix or whatnot, to get a sense whether we'll be able to use this in that kind of mode to identify people with pre-malignant conditions that hopefully we can treat with very low morbidity in some way?
That would be the, you know, holy grail of this effort, to really get at the very, very earliest abnormal growths that are pre-malignant, as you say, that are just prior to these being full-blown cancers. There's a lot of hope that this will be able, that these types of technologies will be able to be successful in that way. I think more likely, probably in cases where the bodily fluid is obtained very close to where the tumor is. So, for example, stool in the case of colon cancer, we can now use to identify adenomas, these premalignant lesions that typically are found by colonoscopy and can be removed. Of course, colonoscopy, as an example that you just gave, is a great way to do this. But the problem is only 60% or so of the population gets colonoscopies. Or other types of early screening.
And it's expensive, as what we would guess a test of the stool would be far less expensive, our guess would be,
That's right. And I think over time, we would all appreciate that simply getting a bodily fluid sample, being able to analyze that molecularly without the patient having to go in, without having to get all the folks involved that would do a normal procedure, like in a colonoscopy, would be much simpler to do. And then those patients that are positive on such a test would then be followed up by a colonoscopy or by the various folks that would be involved in further diagnostic workup.
Yeah, so they can make the diagnosis and, in principle, if you see the pre-malignant condition, treat it while you're there or something.
Yeah.
Which would be a much more efficient use of healthcare resources, presumably.
Absolutely. But even if we can identify pre-malignant lesions, I think one thing to remember is that most cancers today, and many different types of cancer types, are just diagnosed late, unfortunately. And much of the morbidity and mortality of human cancer is because we're just diagnosing late-stage cancers. The cancers are in different parts of the body. They can't be cured by surgery. Therapy doesn't work well because the cancer is now too complicated and it's figured out ways to become resistant. So there's a lot of thinking that if we could just move the stage at which we diagnose cancer patients from stage 4, which is metastatic disease in multiple parts of the body, to earlier stage disease where it's localized, could be easily resected surgically, that would make an immense impact on the lives of cancer patients. The estimates in the study that we just provided alone is that if we could shift the detection rate based on the numbers that I was talking about earlier, about half to two-thirds of cancer patients being stage 1-2 detected, that would literally be millions of lives worldwide that could potentially be saved by this approach. So there's a lot of work to get there and many clinical trials to sort of demonstrate the feasibility and validation of this. But I think the hope is that, with the limited healthcare dollars that we have, we've been putting a lot of resources in therapy, as we should. It's a very noble thing to do, and any patient that has cancer, we need to figure out a way to cure them. But in terms of the outcome for the dollars spent, thinking about early detection, intervention, even prevention is really a wise thing to do, and the impact will probably even be greater.
So that's a little bit of a review that we've just done of where this is headed in the detection and diagnosis arena. One thing that is really at hand, I think you could argue, is when you have someone that you know has a cancer, very oftentimes and essentially within a few years, all cancers will be subjected to genome sequencing to inventory their defects, particularly hoping you find one that would indicate responsiveness to a particular drug. But nonetheless, that information will be available. And then when you apply these same techniques to cancers in the circulation or other ways to non-invasively assess them, you can now monitor the treatments that we already have. So if you have a cancer, you do the sequence of it, it's surgically removed, you go look for those same sequences like you're looking for a particular person at the crime scene. If they're not there, the cancer is innocent. It's not going to threaten your life. If they are there, it's guilty, right? Because you haven't right. you haven't reduced the threat. And this would instruct you perhaps to use or not use additional therapies and the timing to use them. And that seems to me, and I'll throw this at you, that seems to be moving a bit quicker,
yes.
in a sense, enmeshed within the current treatment paradigms. Is that your sense as well?
Absolutely. So I think, you're absolutely right. The mutations in the blood are very similar to what we think of a viral load when you think of an HIV patient. We've really been treating patients with cancer and looking to see how they respond to therapy just by bringing the patient into the clinic or looking through imaging analyses, but that takes a long time and it's really not always accurate. So by looking in the blood, we can get almost a real-time assessment, the tricorder analogy we talked about before, as to how the patient is doing. And it is pretty remarkable. You can detect within about a week whether or not a patient is responding to targeted therapy. These are based on analyses that we and others have presented recently at ACR and at other meetings. There's a dramatic drop in the mutated DNA in the blood when you're treating a patient successfully and their cancer is going away and they're responding for a long term to that therapy. Essentially, it goes away, this level of mutated DNA. If the patient is non-responsive, even though you think they should have been because they were the right mutation, the right kind of therapy, and all bets were that they were going to respond to it, the level of this DNA in the blood essentially stays the same. There's no change. And very early, again, within days, you can figure that out. Even with immune therapy, which is a very new and exciting kind of therapy where we're using the body's own immune system, we're unleashing that against the cancer. In many cases, it's really hard to figure out if the patient's responding to that therapy because the imaging studies, CAT scans, so forth, can be confusing. You've got the immune system coming into the tumor, so in some cases, the tumor looks like it's gotten bigger, but it's actually responding really well to the therapy. There, too, within several weeks, about a month, we can see a dramatic drop in patients that respond to therapy. While in patients that don't respond to therapy, the levels stay relatively similar. So the hope is that this kind of information going forward, just as you said, can be used to change patients' therapy in real time. You can imagine augmenting therapy in the case of a patient that's not responding or switching therapy altogether. You can also imagine that after surgery, and we can talk about this scenario in more detail, but you want to know, has the patient been cured by surgery alone? This can tell you whether whether the patient still has residual tumor, different parts of the body still having metastatic disease. All this can be done more rapidly now and hopefully will benefit patients in terms of switching therapies, improving their therapies, getting them to have the best care possible.
So another angle on this approach is that many people, as you mentioned, who have a great response to the treatment selected, the cancer ultimately shrinks, often in a more delayed way. The cancer DNA in the circulation, as you and others are reporting, goes down much more quickly. Then after several months, years, or what have you, the cancer can reappear. And often you can see it on an image, and you can see it in this liquid biopsy kind of strategy. But at this point, it may reappear and be able to outfox the treatment that was used before. And by collecting an inventory of the gene defects, comparing it to the one before, there's a lot of hope that you might be able to figure out new vulnerabilities of this cancer that weren't present and the one that you tried to treat before. How is that panning out to your mind?
That's crucial as well. The sad reality is that for almost all targeted therapies, patients initially respond, but in many cases, the tumor comes back. And it comes back because they acquire additional mutations that make them resistant to the therapy. Like you said, they outfox the therapy. And that is a challenge for targeted therapy. It appears to also be a challenge in some patients with immunotherapy, where they're responding, but then the tumor begins to come back. Why are they coming back? In some cases, we can answer that question just by doing these kinds of liquid biopsies. There was an example some time ago of a patient that was initially treated, for example, colon cancer patient, was initially treated with an antibody called cetuximab. They responded to this therapy, but then years later, they weren't doing so well. And it looked like some of their tumors were growing, others were staying the same, but they had multiple lesions in their body, multiple tumors, and they couldn't all be biopsied. So we performed a liquid biopsy, and we found that it appeared that this patient had a dramatic increase of a particular gene called MET, which turned out to explain at the time both the mechanism of resistance to the original therapy, but the MET gene is actually a target for new therapies in and of themselves. So potentially that patient could have been placed on that particular therapy to the benefit of the patient, and you know, as a way to outwit the cancer itself. The cancers are extremely devious, though. I mean, an analogy to them is that game whack-a-mole. You know, you whack them in one place, and then they come up somewhere else. And so part of the strategy of that game is being very quick in order to figure out what are the new things that the cancer is coming up with. And so either we get much better therapies at the beginning, or combinations of therapies like we use in HIV, which hopefully will not allow the cancers to come up with any way of getting around these therapies. But if they are getting around the therapies, these liquid biopsies are providing a really rapid way of figuring out what the potential mechanism of resistance is, and then allowing us to switch therapy. And it's partly, I think it's two things. One is the actual mutations themselves, as we talked about. And then the other is that it's the level with the analysis of the blood. We're looking in the blood at how many molecules, how much DNA that's coming from the tumor is there. Is it really like a needle in the haystack, or is it, you know, a bunch of hay in the haystack that's a larger amount there? Can we use that level to tell us whether the patient's getting better, getting worse, staying the same? Again, the analogy that comes to mind is the viral load for HIV, which really went hand in hand with allowing us to develop new therapies against that disease.
Well, one of the things that's been fascinating and love to get your view on is that because effectively cancers are innately disorders of acquired defects in genes, so these gene technologies are going to be applied to cancers and have been quite spectacularly. One can only guess at this point how many total cancers have been sequenced. I suspect that number at this point is quite large. But it's driving even faster, in a sense, than people who were sequencing normal genomes for other purposes, even though they're people trying to figure out whether they're Scottish or Irish or what have you from those things you can see on television. But some of the things we've learned from that, in my mind, have been extraordinary and somewhat counterintuitive. I think many people would have argued if you smoked a huge amount of cigarettes your whole life and you developed lung cancer, that it wouldn't be surprising to us that there's a lot of mutations in lung cancer. There are things in the cigarette smoke that cause those mutations. We know that. We've known that for years. And the sequencing tells us that we were right when we posited that hypothesis. But I think what's been very surprising is we look at these cancers where there's been exposures creating lots of mutations, many more than the 100 or so, and some of these are the ones of all things that are responding to the immunotherapy, which is thinking much differently about what the immune system is seeing and how we monitor this and how we can think about these mutations that the immune system sees more clearly than others. Where's that headed?
That's a really exciting area. I mean, this is a field that, you know, folks here in the Cancer Center have been working on for decades in the immunology and immunotherapy space. In parallel, there are folks working in genetics and epigenetics, and now you see this convergence of these kinds of therapies with the basic biology you just mentioned of the genome. So the surprising observation is, as you say, that patients with more mutations, and these can be lung cancer patients that were heavy smokers had more mutations in their tumors because of the exposures to smoke. Patients with melanoma because of the exposure to sunlight. There's even some genetic defects that lead to increases in the number of mutations that cancer cells have. These tumors are really very different from their normal counterparts. And because they're so different, in a way, you might say, well, that makes sense. That's why the immune system is recognizing these cancers as almost being like another organism. They see them as being non-self. They're not you. And so they're attacking them better. In looking at the molecular mechanism this in more detail, there's still many hypotheses about why that might be the case. But one straightforward one is to say that it's actually quite simple. The immune system is recognizing these mutated proteins, the mutated parts of your blueprint. They're attacking that. And the more mutated pieces you have in your genome, the better the chances are that your immune system is going to take it out. You know, I saw a very nice analogy to this between the British soccer players and the number of times they try shots on goal and then the number of goals they get. The more shots on goal you try, in many cases, it means that you'll get that you will actually have more goals. If the more mutations you have in a cancer cell, chances are that'll be more recognized by the immune system. Unfortunately, it doesn't always pan out. There are those soccer players that make lots of shots on goal, but they miss every goal, or those that take very few but make them almost all the time. So there are patients that have few mutations, and that's actually one of the things we have to figure out. Who are those patients with very few mutations but that are still responding to immunotherapy? Is it just chance that they responded, or is it specific genes? Is there any way we can recognize those individuals? And then there are some that have many mutations, but for some reason the cancer cell has figured out a way to evade immune therapy in those. But there's great hope that based on the responses of immune therapy in kinds of cancers that we've been talking about, this kind of therapy will be widely applied in the future.
Well, I'll have you handicap how well the English goal scorers are going to behave in the World Cup as it starts a little bit later. But the other thing that I think has been fascinating about the experience of using these genomic tools to analyze cancers is there's a significant advantage that you and others have pointed out by sequencing the normal germline DNA, the DNA hopefully that you're born with, and comparing it to the cancer, because it increases the accuracy and the confidence that when you see a mutation, that it's a mutation and not just one of the million base changes that you and I might have that are different. But what that's done is unveiled a little bit that, and you hinted at this a little bit earlier, when identical twins are born with the same genome, over time, because of occasional mistake here and mistake there, they actually evolve a slightly different genome. And what we're learning, of course, is that many people, particularly in this part of the world, are evolving different blood-forming cells by the age of 70 when cancers come. We've even put a name to the syndrome, clonal hematopoiesis. How many of these stories are there going to be? What should we be sequencing as the most normal DNA that we have?
Well, a couple of things in that question. One is we should never forget that cancer is largely a disease of mutations that occur during one's lifetime in the cells of our bodies that then lead to cancer. But we're also born with all sorts of variants. It's the things that make us different from one another. It's mostly related to, you know, eye color and just normal variation. But there are things in our genomes that also perhaps may make us predisposed to cancer. And one of the things we can learn by sequencing both the tumor but the patient's matched normal specimen is whether a patient is potentially predisposed to cancer. And you know, there are so many more patients walking around with those kinds of mutations than I think were previously anticipated. You know, initially you'd think of families where it's always running in one's family and so forth, and that certainly has been the case. If individuals have cancers, many members of their family, especially at a young age, they should get genetically tested. But we're finding that even patients that don't have that in their families, they might be the first one that they know of that have cancer, even those individuals, a substantial fraction of them may carry germline predisposing mutations. These are things like the BRCA gene mutations or others like PALB2 and so forth that would predispose one to cancer. So it will be really informative as we go on and get these genetic tests even better done in cancer patients to provide that information as well. But you're also bringing up another point, which is also important, which is that as we grow older, unfortunately, our bodies don't stay the same. We're constantly changing. In a way, we're falling apart. And part of that is, for example, what happens to our normal blood cells as we age. And what we have found, and others have pointed out as well, is that a substantial number of these individuals that are healthy have a high fraction of what's called clonal hematopoiesis. That is an abnormal growth of a small number of blood cells that begin to have mutations. We don't yet know what the risk of that is. Sometimes those patients can lead to myelodysplasia or pre-leukemic conditions, some sort of blood cancer. There's reports that they may lead actually to heart disease of some kind as well. So we're still learning about that. Clearly, that's an evolving story in and of itself, and it's an important aspect as we think about these genetic analyses.
And the other thing is it started to pay dividends. Our bone marrow transplant and leukemia group here has noted a curious phenomenon where they have someone with leukemia, and so they get rid of all their blood-forming cells, including the normal ones, and replace them with blood-forming cells from somebody else, often a relative that's somewhat matched immunologically, so that the new immune system doesn't attack the body. But, and thank God this is true, that it's rare, rarely they'll develop a leukemia in the transplanted bone marrow. So in principle, this could have been because it fused with a leukemia cell that was hiding out somewhere, who knows what. But it turns out it was almost always the case that this was from bone marrow from someone who was a bit older, perhaps 70 or so. And when you went back and sequenced the bone marrow from the donor, they had one of these clonal hematopoiesis conditions with mutations in one of these genes that's on its way towards myelodysplasia or leukemia, which is fascinating that you could now change the guidelines for who should donate bone marrow to avoid people of that age because of effectively sequencing match normal along with cancer when that match normal were the blood-forming cells. So we've been talking here with Victor Valculescu about where the technology is going, doing DNA sequencing. And the one thing I'm sure Victor will relate to us is that it is astonishing, the technology itself. And I wouldn't be at all surprised. You've seen the demo of this one toy at this point where you put in something that looks like a USB drive and you squirt a little DNA on it and you go away and you come back a couple hours later and has your genome sequenced like you could do this at home. I think that hasn't worked out quite as well as they claimed when they showed that little video. But you and I both believe it's going to get easier, faster, and less expensive, which creates a different problem, and it's one that you've been thinking about in ways in which we can use the information we generate shared as broadly as possible so that progress against cancer can be made most expeditiously. And that is the sheer quantity of data that's generated in this space, especially when you're adding it to the patient's own record and imaging and whatnot. Massive amounts of data, and you're part of efforts to try and get that into one place so that researchers all over the world can look under every rock there is and find every advantage there is of knowing about these gene defects. Tell us about those kind of projects.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when cancer genome sequencing started, as we've been discussing, it was really hard. It was expensive. It took years to do one individual, and it cost hundreds of thousands of dollars. Now it can be done under $1,000 really rapidly. Like you said, it could soon be connected to your iPhone and you'll have a sequence come out. It's pretty amazing. That is generating the possibility of having lots of data, but if the data stays with each patient and or with each physician and doesn't get shared, we're going to lose incredible opportunities to share this with one another. And that amount of data is going to outstrip almost all the research efforts in this space dramatically, if it hasn't already. We just couldn't afford to sequence that many from research budgets alone. So the thought is, how can we capture that kind of information? There are multiple efforts that are beginning to do this. One particular one is was started by the ACR, and it's called the ACR Genie Project. And what that involves is initially 7, now 18 institutions in the US and worldwide that are largely clinical laboratories that are generating this kind of genomic data from standard patient care. And that kind of information is connected to their clinical record and in a de-identified manner is shared initially amongst the institutions and then ultimately with the rest of the world through a web-based portal. And the benefit of that is we are now at about 30,000 individuals that will soon, over the next several years, get to be in the hundreds of thousands of patients that have been analyzed in this way, and where one can identify potentially rare mutations, but allow you to associate that with clinical outcome, response to a certain therapy, resistance to another therapy. Really the same question we began with. How do you get the right therapy to the right patient at the right time? And the best way to do that is to fully understand the types of changes that exist in patients and all the different types of therapies that have been tried. Of course, there'll be many trials that will evaluate this formally by pharma and others. But in the meantime, we're getting a lot of data that we shouldn't be throwing away. So the AACR Genie Project is a great way for us to share that kind of information and for us to all learn from it.
Well, thank you, Victor, for joining us today. We've been here with Victor Valculescu, one of the people working to transform cancer research and cancer medicine with genome analysis technologies, which of course reminds me that you can find us on Facebook or on Twitter at Hopkins Kimmel. Also look for these podcasts on iTunes, look for Johns Hopkins or Hopkins and Kimmel, and you'll find us right next to your favorite songs. And with that, thank you.
Thank you.